Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at America's role as the world's leading superpower. The job of U.S. president is one which has great impact beyond its own borders. But Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have very different ideas about the role of the U.S. abroad. What is America's place in the world today? And how would Trump and Harris shape that role? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. This is Andrew Peach. Iran has launched a barrage of missiles into Israel. Oil prices are up. We'll have the latest on that for you. And the impact that the Israeli airstrikes are having on businesses and the economy in Lebanon.
I was in with a travel agent today. His phone is just constantly ringing because so many people are trying to leave the country. And he managed to get them flights to Rome in 2 days for $1,800.
Also today, the impact of Hurricane Helene in the US.
All of the beautiful little towns and villages that we have around the place that are all tourist attractions, Hot Springs, Marshall and Chimney Rock Village, essential and vital to our local economy, just taken away by flooding.
And a Canadian government minister tells us she doesn't want a trade war with China. We love it when you get in touch. The email address is world.business@bbc.co.uk. First today. These are the sirens in Tel Aviv and across Israel as Iran launched that barrage of missiles. According to the Israel Defense Forces, there were about 180 of them in total. Civilians were told to take refuge in shelters. The chief spokesperson for Israel's military, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, said they would retaliate.
We are on high readiness, on the defense and the offense. We will protect the citizens of Israel. This fire will have consequences. We have plan. We will act at a place and time of our decision.
In the last hour, the U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris reiterated American support for Israel.
As I have said, I will always ensure Israel has the ability to defend itself against Iran and Iran-backed terrorist militias. My commitment to the security of Israel is unwavering. And let us be clear, Iran is not only a threat to Israel, Iran is also a threat to American personnel in the region, American interests, and innocent civilians across the region who suffer at the hands of Iran-based and backed terrorist proxies.
Meanwhile, Israel has continued to bombard Lebanon as it seeks to push home its advantage over the Iranian-backed Hezbollah group. I've been talking to Sally Hayden of the Irish Times, who's in Beirut.
It's kind of impossible to explain in some senses just the scale of the uncertainty. It's obviously nobody knows where it could be hit next. I mean, they have kept two so-called Hezbollah strongholds. But yesterday there was an airstrike on the Kola intersection in central Beirut. And that was the first strike on central Beirut. And I think that scared people because they were thinking this is, again, a very busy area. Dahiyeh, by the way, also is very busy and very heavily populated. And obviously that's where we've seen a lot of airstrikes. But now that there was one in another area, like I interviewed a man who was selling coffee across the road and he witnessed that attack. And he said, you know, I don't know where it could be struck next. So yeah, there's a general sense of terror. There's displaced people all over the place, you know. So obviously the authorities are saying up to 1 million people have been displaced. Like, it's very obvious anywhere you're walking pretty much in Beirut right now.
There's just people lined along walls. There's people, you know, sleeping on cardboard, sitting on mats.
I was speaking to a woman yesterday in Beirut whose family runs a shop, and the shop is closed because the family are living in it, sleeping on the floor. Are a lot of businesses closed for reasons like that?
And I think some businesses have actually repurposed themselves as places that are now collecting donations and making food and distributing that food to displaced people. Some are open, and I was in Jumaisi today. It was like a very busy street full of restaurants and bars, and most of the businesses there seem to be closed, but there were a few open. And I was talking to a bartender outside one, and he said, you know, we shut for 3 days and now we've decided we may as well open again. And I don't know, was he totally in denial? Because he was kind of saying, you know, things could be a bit normal now. And I was like, I don't think that they're normal. But from talking to people who run businesses as well on that street, part of the issue is that they want to take care of their staff, and everybody reacts in different ways. And some people seem to want to act like everything is okay, and others are really just not capable of doing that for very understandable reasons. And also it depends where people come from. Like, I was talking to another man who works in a bar on that same street today, and he was saying his whole family had to be moved, and he actually had 10 cats as well who were in Dahie, and so the suburb, you know, that has been very heavily targeted, and so he had to move his parents and his cats. But at the same stage, he obviously wants to earn money to continue to be able to support himself and them.
Saving the cats comes up in every conversation I have. I suppose it depends what kind of business you're running as well. You know, people need essential supplies. People don't need to go out for coffee or go out for dinner.
Yeah, I mean, and I was also in one business that I guess is in some ways booming and in some ways obviously not. I was in with a travel agent today, and his phone is just constantly ringing because so many people are trying to leave the country. And I both went into a travel agency and then to Middle East Airlines, and Middle East Airlines said that they basically don't have flights available for the next 2 weeks, whereas the travel agent did manage to, I was with people who were trying to book flights, and he managed to get them flights to Rome in 2 days for $1,800 each, and that's a one-way flight, and they don't even need to go to Rome, but that was just them trying to get on a flight to anywhere, basically.
To somewhere. Longer term, in terms of rebuilding the Lebanese economy, which let's remember was in dire straits anyway, it's going to be a long road to getting the Lebanese economy back on track in any sense.
People are still taking stock of what's happening, and obviously I'm sure lots of people know about the economic crisis that technically began in 2019, though I think was brewing for a long time before this. They've had one of the highest levels of inflation in the world. When I first came here in 2016, a dollar was 1500 lira, and when I came back last year it had briefly passed 100,000 lira, and now I think it's around 90,000. So a lot of people who were doing okay were plunged into poverty, and also a lot of people who had money in the bank, that money effectively disappeared, and that has really crippled people. And then there's things like the Beirut blast. Actually, I met a woman today as well in Jumaisi who said that her house had been destroyed by the 2020 Beirut blast, and she still hasn't managed to restore it, you know. And so there's just kind of crisis after crisis. It's looking pretty impossible for a lot of people right now.
And that was Sally Hayden of the Irish Times talking to me from Beirut. Now, given everything that's happening, and particularly those Iranian strikes on Israel in recent hours, how are oil prices doing? Let's talk to Ayako Yoshioka, who's Senior Portfolio Manager at the Wealth Enhancement Group in Los Angeles. First of all, oil prices were up even before the strikes happened, just on the suggestion that they might.
Correct. Although oil prices in general have been down over the last year, about 20% from where the prices were last year.
Okay. So, I mean, when I looked earlier, we were talking about £53, $70 a barrel, Brent crude at $73 a barrel. What's the deal now?
Yes, so they were up about 3% today, with Brent crude ending around $74.50.
And the context of all of this is that the prices have been going in the other direction. So is this some kind of market correction, or what would you expect to happen next?
I think there's some reason for elevated prices, at least in the near term. The overall prices had been down for, like I said, the last year. And so having this additional tension in the Mideast does mean that prices could go up a little bit.
Okay, we'll come back for a bit more market analysis of what else has been happening today with Ayoko later in World Business Report. Thousands of people have crossed from Lebanon to Syria as this conflict escalates. Karim Shah is an independent Syrian economist and consultant. I asked Karim whether a war-torn country can cope with all these new arrivals with its own dwindling economy.
The latest data we have relates to the 29th of September, and it's actually 70,000 people. The vast majority are actually Lebanese nationals, primarily because Syrians who have been living in Lebanon know that actually it might be a one-way ticket. They know if they leave to Syria, they might not be able to come back to Lebanon. And there's nearly 1.5 million Syrians in Lebanon at the moment, making Lebanon the largest host of refugees in the world in per capita terms.
Let's talk about the state of the Syrian economy before this episode.
Basically, the Syrian economy following the conflict contracted by almost two-thirds. It's now just a shadow of what it was in 2011. But over the past few years, it actually started to stabilize at a very, very low level, just because of the protracted nature of the conflict. But Syria's export sector has been decimated. The agricultural sector has also been heavily impacted, barely able to feed Syrians who are still in the country. But then the financial meltdown in neighboring Lebanon actually was one of the factors that actually affected the Syrian economy significantly in 2019 and 2020. Now you have this new episode that's only going to make matters worse.
Can Syria cope with large numbers of people suddenly arriving?
I'm not expecting a large number of people to arrive in Syria, mainly because most people in Lebanon believe, rather accurately, that they're better off staying in Lebanon because Syria doesn't have the capacity to host them. For example, in terms of electricity supply, you're lucky if you get a few hours every day of public electricity. Lebanese nationals who are arriving are not arriving into proper shelters. There are people who know where to stay or who have relatives in Syria. So I suspect the number of people might increase a little bit, but I don't see it actually becoming a significant weight on Syria's economy in terms of number.
But you've already got tens of thousands of people who've arrived. Are there any government services that can cope with that? Are there sufficient supplies to feed extra people, or will we see prices rising?
I mean, what I suspect would happen is increased pressure on public services that are already extremely strained, but the weight of responding to these new arrivals would be on the shoulders of the United Nations, basically, if we're talking about regime-held Syria. And most people fleeing Lebanon are actually going into that specific region of the country, which is regime-held Syria. I suspect the UN would launch a flash appeal in Syria, as it just did for Lebanon, to get more funding and to respond to the needs of these new arrivals.
But even looking beyond the extra people, what I'm getting is a sense that the economies of Syria and Lebanon are highly interdependent. So the fact that Lebanon is now going to be in difficulties for a long time is going to send Syria's economy back in the wrong direction.
The two economies have long been interconnected. The interdependency between them goes back for centuries. In fact, back when the two countries were the same country. But actually what happened after the financial meltdown in Lebanon in 2019 and 2020 is interesting in the sense that that connection has actually weakened. The two exchange rates, for example, do not seem to be as connected as they were before the financial meltdown, basically because most of the money that Syrians had in Lebanese banks basically just disappeared overnight. And even in terms of bilateral trade, the trade between the two countries has actually collapsed. I mean, in 2023, according to Lebanese official statistics, Lebanese exports to Syria declined by 80%. So the connectedness between these two economies has weakened significantly, but it's still nonetheless quite strong. Now, what would actually happen going forward, I think, is basically both economies being hit. The main channel is the decline in economic activity, the activity of the private sector, and the inability of both public sectors to cope with providing public services to the people in their
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
One of his HR team approached me and said, the chairman would like you to work in his office.
It was pretty quick that my gut instinct started to go, this is not right.
The only thing that he was interested in was touching my body.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Countries.
This is World Business Report from the BBC World Service. In the aftermath of Hurricane Helene, which struck the southeast of the US over the weekend, at least 135 people died across six states. Hundreds remain missing. Maybe they're stuck in their home. Maybe they can't contact family members because communications infrastructure has failed. Hundreds of roads are closed, especially in the Carolinas. Mike Cooper lives in Asheville in North Carolina. You might remember Mike's voice as a BBC World Service newsreader.
There are lines out of petrol stations, gas stations everywhere. There are places where petrol is being restricted because it's obviously more important that emergency services have that than the general public. So we're seeing a lot of that at the moment. What we are starting to see is a real community effort in terms of places that have food or can distribute food, starting to do that. Where we live, we're about 7 miles up a mountain valley, and you know, our house is on higher ground, so we were fortunate in terms of not having too much damage to the house itself, but like a lot of other people, we're waking up and starting to assess and finding what damage we have to our properties. Quite often we're finding things like roads have been washed out. They did manage to get one of our interstates open again today, and I know that FEMA and the National Guard are now on the ground and starting to marshal the support effort more.
Are people panicked as they queue up for supplies of things they need and wonder how this is going to play out?
Not seeing a lot of that so far. Obviously, it has the potential to spill over into that at any point, and the longer it goes on, the more people's tempers and nerves and patience will be frayed, and I'm sure we'll start to see more of that. Right now, from what I'm seeing, there seems to be more of a community spirit in terms of people trying to work out how they can help one another, which is very heartening.
Has any help arrived from anywhere else?
In terms of communication, we're at the point now, 4 or 5 days in, where emergency generators that power things like our local TV station, we were told that that will go off air when the generator that powers the transmitter on top of the mountain runs out of fuel, that will go off, and anybody who isn't able to get online to get updates won't be able to get updates from the local TV station. So we're starting to run into those kind of problems. But what I did manage to find out before we lost power again about half an hour ago was that, yeah, the National Guard are now on the scene. FEMA are now on the scene. We're starting to get things like corporate responses from companies like Walmart and other companies trying to work out how they can get food and supplies into the area. I think the magnitude of what we're going through here is really starting to become apparent to the outside world, and that's a good thing.
Your place hasn't been badly damaged, but what sort of damage are other people dealing with?
The difference between something like this hitting somewhere like Florida, where the highest point in the state is something like 350 feet, and hitting somewhere like Western North Carolina, where we live in the mountains, is that in Florida, flood water drains away fairly quickly. What problems we have here is that with it being mountains, being mountain ravines and creeks, water comes down mountains, becomes a huge body of flowing water, and that then starts to do things like wash away bridges, wash away road carriageways and so on, and we're seeing a lot of that throughout the area. There are people stranded at this point where rescue services can't get to them because the bridges over ravines and over valleys and so on have been washed out, and they physically can't reach them.
And does it feel at this point as though the place has been changed? You know, businesses will be closed down, will never open up again. Some of the infrastructure won't ever exist again. Does it feel like it's had that sort of effect?
Yeah, absolutely. My sense of relief on Saturday morning turned very quickly to a sense of grief on Friday afternoon as I started to consider some of this stuff. I mean, we rely on tourism here. Asheville itself is a town of 95,000 people. We get 13 to 14 million visitors a year, and they come here because of the mountain amenities. They come here for river activities, mountain climbing, hiking, all of the beautiful little towns and villages that we have around the place that are all tourist attractions. Some of those have just been swept away. We've lost at least three towns that I know of: Hot Springs, Marshall, and Chimney Rock Village, all beautiful tourist spots and essential and vital to our local economy, just taken away by flooding. And there are certainly businesses that will never recover from this. People here still talk about the great flood that happened in 2004 when we had two storm systems that came in one after another, and they talk about that as historic flooding. We're in no doubt at this point that we're well beyond that. The other big flood that we talk about here is the great Asheville flood of 1916, and the feeling seems to be that this was more water than that.
Mike Cooper in Asheville, North Carolina. Canada's international trade minister has told the BBC she hopes her country isn't entering a trade war with China. Mary Ng's comments come as new tariffs of 100% on Chinese electric vehicles come into force in a move similar to those already in place in the US and the EU. All of them concerned that China's cheap cars are distorting the global market for this emerging technology. Mary Ng has been talking to Jonathan Josephs.
We know that China has an intentional state-directed policy of overcapacity, and that they generally don't meet the same labor and environmental standards as Canadian producers do. So these tariffs are really a necessary measure to counter those practices and that really distort competition. And I think what you're seeing in Canada's decision is a decision that will ensure that we stand up for our workers and our manufacturers, and that we are building those EVs of the future and also standing up for fair trade.
As you will know, your critics will say these tariffs mean Canadians will be paying more for electric vehicles, and that it will therefore become harder for them to take this action that helps tackle climate change. What do you say in response?
We have a very, very robust climate action plan here in Canada. In fact, our government has put forward a plan where in Canada, by 2030, that we will have electric vehicles all across the country. We've got incentives that are in place to help Canadian consumers in the purchasing and the adoption of electric vehicles.
China's already started the process of retaliating against these tariffs. Your canola oil producers look like they're in the firing line. Can you afford to win a trade war against the world's second biggest economy?
Well, I hope that we're not entering a trade war. I mean, what I said and what this is about is making sure that we are countering practices that are distortive in the global marketplace. But on the issue of Canadian canola, no one has ever accused Canadian producers of ever dumping into a market.
You say you're not interested in a trade war, but your government is already looking at tariffs on Chinese EV batteries, semiconductors, solar products, and critical minerals. Are you sure that that won't lead to a trade war?
I think what that is intended to do is ensure that there's a level playing field. We are imposing a 25% tariff on steel and aluminum products imported by China that will come into effect the middle of October. So what we're trying to do here is stand up for a fair trading system.
Canada's International Trade Minister, Mary Ng. Now, Ayako Yoshoka is still with us from Los Angeles, looking at US stocks today. Ayako, there's a lot of red. What's going on?
Sure. So after a very positive month of September, we started the month of October down 0.9%. Part of it is probably just a lot of the headline news that we saw today, but also just profit taking after a very good month in September.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed for that. Let's go to Panama next, one of the wettest countries in the world. It has a canal which earns it billions of dollars every year. So you'd think it should be pretty straightforward to meet the water needs of its population of about 4 million people. Many people don't have access to piped water, though, and the Canal Authority in Panama is still dealing with the effects of a drought there, which lost it hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue as ship crossings were reduced. One solution is to create a new reservoir. That, though, would mean thousands of people losing their homes and their land. Let's get the story from Bob Howard. Leonardo runs a small shop in the community of La Siesta de Tocumen, just outside Panama City and down the road from its international airport. His store used to sell fresh chicken and pork, but there's no mains piped water here, so Leonardo had to close his butchers and open a little general store instead.
Well, I have to stop selling chicken and pork because I didn't have enough water. Without it, I couldn't sell meat because good hygiene requires you to have water. So I have to close down the business.
In one of the wettest countries in the world, Leonardo, like hundreds of thousands of Panamanians, relies on tankers coming to supply him with water. In the rainy season, the water is here, but the government has failed to invest in a comprehensive mains piped system, which would supply everybody in the country. And with the population growing, things are getting worse, and the water tankers are not always reliable.
It arrives in tankers every 3 or 4 days. Before, it took up to 15 days for the water to arrive here. The government keeps saying it will solve it, but we are still waiting.
The state water company that supplies most households says it has never had the budget from the government to supply everybody with piped mains water. But it is investing $20 million to help bring it to 3 communities, totaling 60,000 people. It estimates it will need $800 million to connect everybody. But climate change means even in a place as wet as Panama, there may not always be enough water to supply the 4 million plus population and work the canal's massive locks. Each ship which traverses the canal uses an astonishing 50 million gallons of water as the locks raise it up and then lower it down as it crosses from the Pacific to the Atlantic and vice versa. Last year, there was a drought and the canal had to reduce its traffic on some days by a third, losing the country hundreds of millions of dollars. One solution is the building of a new lake to store water in the basin of the Rio Indio. The problem, at least 2,000 people will have to be relocated, and some don't trust the canal authority to do right by them. Olegario Cedeño is a community leader in the Rio Indio area.
What they have told us is that we are going to be relocated to other properties like the ones we have, which is impossible because we all have very different properties. Since they announced the building of the reservoir, they've shown us no respect for our land, just total contempt.
The canal authority, however, insists that a growing population, a sustained demand by shipping companies to use the canal, and climate change means new solutions must be found. Emilia Espino de Marotta is the deputy administrator of the Panama Canal Authority.
The water usage for canal operations has been very, very efficient, but we do have a very increased population. So as time change and things evolve, you need to adapt to new situations.
The latest from the Middle East on the live page at bbc.com/news. My colleague Tom Bateman in Washington has written a piece about how we're seeing the cycle of escalation in the Middle East, exactly the thing that President Joe Biden has spent months and months trying to avoid, even though he's saying he's remaining supportive of Israel. Also, the very latest is that the Israeli military has ordered the evacuation of 2 areas of Beirut, which they say will face action in the near future. bbc.com/news for more. From me, Andrew Peach, thank you for being with us.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
One of his HR team approached me and said, the chairman would like you to work in his office.
It was pretty quick that my gut instinct started to go, this is not right.
The only thing that he was interested in was touching my body.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.